Thank you very much. Thanks for the invitation to this great symposium. This first slide is to remind us that today is the day is longer than the night. We are moving towards spring, towards enriched times. And this is 1st of May in June. This is a university building. And these are the magnolias. And let's see if we can. Doesn't work. And this is me on 1st of May during the transmission on TV4. Do you watch TV4 here? Swedish. At 6 o'clock on May 1st, look to the right for this guy. So we will sing spring songs during the absolute best time in Lund. So among those in Lund are my collaborators, which I want to acknowledge immediately, otherwise I forget, and also two important collaborators, Jasna Chris from Quebec and Adam Bauer from Washington University. So we are going to, what I'm going to talk about is the enriched environment, and we have heard a lot of historical reflections. And I've not met Donald Hebb myself, but he's the one in the late 40s that discovered by serendipity, as all big discoveries are, the effect of enriched environment. And I only have heard this story, and if I'm improving it, it's only for the better. So he brought home rats and let them loose. I don't know if he brought them for the kids, and they were running around in his library until they started to chew up the most expensive volumes in the library. So he brought them back to the lab, and when he was studying memory, he found that there was kind of a big variety in terms of learning. It turns out that these animals have been running around and chewing the Encyclopedia Britannica were much smarter, not because they read, but actually that they roamed in this enriched environment. That started the whole story. And there are several other contributors here to the basic science of enriched environment. And I would like to mention Barbro Johansson in Lund, who actually applied enriched environment for the first time to stroke. And she has done a lot of seminal work on enriched environment. I want to acknowledge that. And one of the important findings was that the social component was important in the enriched environment for the effect. And the social component for rats is sleeping together with three fellows in a sewage tube. Who wouldn't love to do that? And there was one sneaking in on the other side. So we had adopted this method to study molecular mechanisms of stroke recovery. Although enriched environment is not task-specific training, as you may have in your clinical setting, the remarkable recovery of function of the rats and mice is sufficient for us to start looking to the mechanisms. And our particular target is to develop a pharmacological tool that can mimic enriched environment. And then try possibly, once patients are well stratified for clinical trials, and we have heard the first step toward that direction, we can start testing that in the clinic. So rats are four-legged, small creatures with a tail. They are not human beings. So this is experimental and explorative. So I just say that, so you don't immediately rush to home and start to employ all the data in a rehabilitation. It's easy that scientists take our experimental data prematurely and are very enthusiastic, and when they fail, we get to blame. And I don't take shit. Okay, so our experimental paradigm is the following: that we induce an experimental stroke, either most recently a phototraumatic stroke, as Teresa Jones described yesterday. Then we wait 2 days, and we know from a lot of studies that it takes 2 days for the infarct to mature. At 2 days, whatever happens after 2 days is something that is going on in the surviving tissue. It's remodeling or other processes. So neurodegeneration is all gone. So any treatment is not neuroprotection, because we always check if the infarct is affected by our treatment. And so far, this has never happened. So we wait 2 days and test function here. And then we select animals for severe damage. And we do that because we don't want to have a spread of different functions where we are looking for mechanism. We take, for example, paw placement. If the rat puts the paw on the table, which it normally does, or when it's completely paretic, it doesn't react to sensory input, then we know that there is a severe deficit. The infarct usually is within a certain range. Then after 2 days with a severe deficit, we start investigating mechanism, treatments, etc. A very simple method. So here we have the enriched environment in mice. Again, can't forget tubings. Sewer tubings, very important. They climb, and they are always 6 to 10 fellows, so they need the hierarchy, the interaction, everything that makes them happy. And they are very energetic, so this is not a very weak stimulation. They are forcing themselves by their social interaction to actually climb and defend territories. So it is a strong somatosensory input. And just to show you, I don't know if anybody, I'm sure you have seen these movies of the effect of enriched environment, but it's really dramatic. So here we have two mice that afterwards, after the 2 week period, when they were sacrificed, that they had exactly the same infarct size. So the group, on group basis, they have the same infarct. And this is a rotating pole rod, so the mouse has to run across it and balance all four legs and the tail and cross a 1 meter pole. So this first has been 4 weeks in a standard cage. This worked before. Then you can see slowly, and he cheating with the tail. Otherwise, it was actually drop off. Usually, they drop off, but by four weeks, they barely make it. So this guy has been 4 weeks, 3 hours a day in an enriched environment. Not perfect, but remarkable. And this is my patients. And they better perform like this, I don't think. Anyhow, so So this is a rotating pole score, and Bob Johansson had done a huge number of different tests regarding this. But we employ this in mouse. We usually now use mice because they're cheaper, faster to do, and they perform similar to rats, but they are vicious. They bite terribly. So here we have the time dependence. We actually need to have the animals for 4 weeks to have the full effect on the enriched environment. If we have them for 2 weeks and then put them back in standard cage, they lose the effect. So at least this is similar, that we have to have a continuous training. And this is 4 weeks the enriched cage compared to standard, and then 4 weeks off. And this is 8 weeks in the enriched cage. And essentially there is not a lot of difference. We haven't gone further, but I think we need to have quite a long time to solidify this improvement. You can also see that there is a better outcome. So there is a spontaneous recovery of the rotating pole test. So this is the phototrophotic model in the mouse. It's a cortical lesion. You can see here it affects the motor sensory areas, the motor areas, F2 and M1. And this is a very particular test. So it is a test for we move the limb like that towards the table, and when it hit, not normally when the paw hits the table, the mouse takes up the paw. After phototrophotic stroke, you hit the table and it's paretic, but only if we take away the vision and the sensation of the chin. So it is like this sensory test you have in patients where they can't see this drawing table. If they have the vision, it's easier to do. So the vision masks the deficit. So this is a very particular deficit, but essentially all animals in the standard cage will not recover. But while essentially all animals will recover some function in the enriched environment. And this is a nice almost all or none effect that we can explore. So again, I will come back to this. Let's look a bit into the mechanisms. And you've heard that after stroke, the whole brain is affected, and this will be my theme here, that there are specific effects and there are global effects on the brain, and that in many instances is similar to what we see in humans. So during recovery, there is a lot of cell genesis. There are neurogenesis, new vessels are born, and everything moves to the scar to contain the infarct as fast as possible, to glue all the holes. So you see new neuroblasts, astrocytes, glia cells, and they form this scar so they contain the infarct so that can be resolved and the tissue, intact tissue, can recover as fast as possible. And essentially, here we have our pyramidal neuron that is affected by all these factors affecting the neurotransmission. And this area, particularly the peri-infarct, is highly dynamic during the first month after stroke. So how does enriched environment, and enriched environment is what I also call sensory or multisensory stimulation, affect plasticity. So it affects both the response of inflammatory containment, but that is inflammation, I will come back to that, and recovery of function of the principal neurons, that is the pure plasticity or neuronal plasticity, which we have heard about a lot. So I will go into one specific type, and I will come, this will touch a bit about what Randy Nudo talked, and also about the critical period. And here we have the microcircuitries in the cortex. So there come input from all over the brain to one layer of cells, so they instruct another principal neuron either to send a command or do some cognitive process. And then there are the inhibitory neurons that was only mentioned once yesterday. And these are the parvalbumin, the GABA cells containing parvalbumin. And they are gatekeepers of the microcircuitry. Nothing happens, nothing is processed unless they decide. So they are fast spiking cells. They regulate the excitability. We heard a lot about excitability, which is necessary for remodeling. They are regulators of sensory processing and other stuff. These cells are very special. So they are surrounded by a cytoskeleton, a skeleton extracellular matrix. It's called perineuronal net. It's a net of huge molecules, and when we stain them red, you can see here, can you see it? And there is the green, and that is parvalbumin. So this is a parvalbumin GABAergic neuron, which is surrounded by these perineuronal nets. And always when I find some mechanism, I always go to my colleague, Elisabeth Englund, the professor of pathology, and she has a bank of brains from diseased stroke patients, and also perfused brains, so we can see, is this something that is actually present in man? And here is the perineuronal net, the GABAergic neuron in a human specimen, and it's very similar to the rat stuff. So these PNN, perineuronal nets, surrounding the cell, they close the possibility for axons to make contact. But once it's open, either channels can be inserted or new synapses can be inserted. So this PNN is important to stabilize synapses once the contacts are formed, and it limits the plasticity during development. So during development, all kind of contacts are formed, and once they are formed, the PNN surrounds these synapses, and you have a stable adult network. So these are the ones that close the critical period Alex Dromerick talked about. So degrading the PNN opens the critical period. And this is something that is explored a lot in amblyopia, where one wants to open up the critical period again so the kids can learn vision and restore the acuity. So after stroke, we looked on these PNN. You can see them here in standard cage. These are the dark dots. And this is enriched cage. So they are disappearing, but not really. They are actually being partially degraded. So here we have the standard cage GABAergic neurons with a lot of structure. And here we have enriched environment. You can visually see that they are degraded, a lot of holes that actually there are possibilities for plasticity to occur. And you can see here, this is at 9 weeks of enriched housing. So this shows the robustness of enriched environment. It actually, you can see the degradation of extracellular matrix, and this occurs at the same time as we activate proteases, the protein degradation enzymes. So when we measure activity of MMP9, metalloprotease 9, we see an increase in activity by the enriched environment. So this is a highly specific process, and it's activated degradation, but in order to open up a critical period. And what we think then, that rich environment provides a robust structural modification stimulus. It actually reverses development, so it puts the brain into a more young stage. That was already proposed by Kramer and Sharp. And it opens a critical period for plasticity in stroke. So from a pharmacological point of view, the MMPs are not very good targets, because it's very difficult to have an activator of a protease. And if you activate too early, they are actually detrimental. We left that field. Simply, we are not very sentimental. If this is no way, no go, there is no time for us to stay. So we went on, and we found that one very important effect of stroke is the inflammatory response, that the entire brain is reacting to the big lesion with inflammatory cells entering the brain and forming this wound healing process. But the cytokines and chemokines, the mediator of inflammation, they also modify function of neurons, which could actually be one of the causes why we have a decrease in activity. And the inflammatory cells, this is microglia in a normal brain, and you can see that they are connected in a big network through the entire brain. This is an alternative network to the neuronal network. Those astrocytes, so they communicate. If damage occurs on one place, actually all the microglia knows that something is going on, and they are alerted. And one of the cells that form these inflammatory factors, one is called MIF, migration inhibitory factor, other GABA PD cells. So here we have parvalbumin, here we have MIF, and they are fully colocalized. And this is the pro-inflammatory cytokine in standard animals. You see a strong band, and this is enriched environment. So the infarct size were the same, but the inflammatory response is much lower. So enriched environment, multisensory stimulation decreases brain inflammation. And when we measured other cytokines like this interleukin 1 beta, here we have stroke in standard, stroke in enriched, and it's almost back to the control level. This is TNF-alpha, standard cage, enriched cage. It's almost gone. So it has an extremely strong effect on brain inflammation. So we explored one particular cytokine. It's SDF1. It's the CXCL12 you can see the levels of this in the standard cage, and this is in the enriched cage. And again, the level of this cytokine is almost normalized, and also the receptor for this cytokine. And it turns out that there is a drug, it's called plerixafor, or AMD3100, which is an antagonist to CXCR4. So this drug would act, have the same effect as enriched environment. It's FDA approved for other indication by Sanofi Adventis, and so we employed this drug. Reduced stroke. After 2 days, we started treatment for 5 days, and assessed the behavior on the rotating pole, and there was a significant improvement of function. So we went to Sanofi Adventis and offered them the results, and hope they would move it or explore it for a clinical use. So we'll see. The problem again with inflammation and with essentially all processes in the brain is that there is good and there is bad and there is the ugly. Well, let's talk about the good and the bad. And inflammation has several phases of Janus here. So it's bad immediately after stroke because inflammation aggravates damage. Then comes a period of good when it removes the debris so new cells pathways can be formed. And then later on comes a bad period again because they interfere with neurotransmission. And that makes this also a very difficult target. So if you want to intervene with inflammation here, where shall we start the treatment? And you may go into either good or bad periods. What the rich environment does, that it does something lagom. We have a Swedish word, lagom. Does everybody know what that means? It's lagom. that it sets, it takes away the bad and stimulates the good stuff. So it's better to have an enriched environment. And we can discuss what actually this means, what that is to humans, whether that is, I would say, training in a positive environment where we have all kinds of music, dancing, but at the same time strong training. are there other possibilities that we can use taking this into consideration, that we need to have some global effect? And we have now the serotonin system and the dopamine system, where the cell bodies are there, but the axon more or less cover like a network across the entire brain. The same goes for dopamine. And they are now in clinical trials for stroke recovery, the serotonin uptake inhibitor. SSRIs, the fluoxetine, and L-DOPA has been around for some time. And before this neutral trial that showed no effect of L-DOPA treatment was published, there were a couple of small trials showing that the dopamine system is involved in motor learning. And small trials with L-DOPA were actually positive. So we tested L-DOPA in our rats, stroke, 2 days, selective sorting, dose-dependent treatment with L-DOPA, and you can see here the effect on recovery of function, and there is a dose-dependent, highest dose improves function with L-DOPA treatment. just for you to not all of our experiments are successful, so 90% I will not talk about. So don't think that I'm only, everything that I'm touching is magic. So of course, L-DOPA or dopamine system may affect plasticity, but actually it does affect inflammation. L-DOPA is anti-inflammatory. So 5 days treatment with L-DOPA decreases the level of inflammatory markers. So this is vehicle L-DOPA treated. DOPA-treated IL-4, TNF-alpha, interferon-gamma. So here is an example of a compound, a drug that we would expect to be anti-inflammatory, it actually is. So conclusion two here is that housing in rich environment depresses post-stroke inflammatory response and provides a balanced log of regulation of good and bad inflammation. This is a take home. This is sufficient for me to have an enriched environment. So, as I said before, enriched environment is a multisensory stimulation. It has components stimulating somatosensory, motor, factor, tactile, auditory, visual, and social. With, again, stimulating more or less the entire brain. Yesterday we heard about the connectome, which now can be studied with various methods, where the brain is connected among each other in hubs. We can actually study the connectome in the rat and mouse. And we use the a method with, in a collaboration with Adam Bauer at Washington University. So this is a mouse skull, and the mouse skull is very transparent. So we put oil on top of it. You can actually see the surface of the cortex. And when we illuminate with LEDs, 3 LEDs, we can measure the level of deoxygenated hemoglobin, as in fMRI. But this is much smarter. Well, it's cheaper. So we have set up this on the bench in the lab. It's $40,000. And it gives the same signals and the resting state fMRI. This is called resting state optical intrinsic signaling. And here we have 128 points. So the computer calculates the fluctuation in the resting state without stimulation of oxygen saturation, and then in each point of the brain. And then it checks all pixels and compares them, and those that correlate with each other are considered to be connected. So if we had this blue fluctuation in resting state, which is signifies the ongoing activity of neurons, the green and the blue are connected and the red are not connected. So with this we can get areas which are connected to each other. So here we have motor cortex, here we have visual cortex in the rat and the mouse. This is somatosensory area hub, and this is retrosplenial, which is kind of an area of cognition. It's difficult to interview a rat if they are thinking about life and themselves. This is considered the default mode network. And these are exactly those areas which we get stimulated by enriched environment. So we looked into what happens with the connectome, the entire connectome, after stroke and enriched environment. And here are the results. Here we have the lesion, the black area here. This is standard animal. Let me go through this. So here it's a peri-infarct, and here we lose connectivity. So here we have the damage, but the connectivity is lost. Also on the other side, on the contralateral hemisphere, and this is animal 40 days in the enriched environment, and you can by eye see how the connectivity recovers in the peri-infarct, but also here. So if we ask the computer to subtract standard from enriched, we get this picture. You have increased connectivity among neurons in M1, in the primary motor cortex, or ipsilateral, contralateral, but also in M2, which is kind of the premotor or the posterior parietal cortex. And these are the significant changes. And the posterior parietal cortex, M2 and M1, are considered to be important for visuospatial processing in the mouse, which we now can conclude that housing the enriched environment modulates the entire connectome of the brain in multiple regions for motor control and visual spatial processing. And visual spatial processing, motor control, this is exactly the test we are doing, the poor placement test, where the animal actually needs vision and chip to process this information, to move the paw on the table. And this is quite remarkable, I think, and have an implication also for the clinical assessment. And we heard about stratification. The resting state fMRI and the animal fMRI are very similar. So there we have a very nice translational possibility. So I have some more time. I could skip that, but I think you want to hear that too. So this, what we now did was that, and this is serendipity. It's because I'm smart. So I found and I can't disclose this. The compound, because we are negotiating for clinical use. So we found a compound that actually supports and is synergistic to enriched environment. So here we have the poor placement test, 40 days in standard environment, and this enriched environment. And then we combine the compound, it's called SIN, and we have this increase in function or poor placement function. If we block this receptor, it's a receptor, we completely obliterate the enriched environment effect. So the pre-treatment with the blocker, and we put them in enriched environment, nothing happens. So we have identified a signaling pathway for the enriched environment, which is druggable. And you can see here we have the effect on standard animals so this is a sub-effective dose, so this is full effective dose. And you can appreciate the enhancement of spontaneous recovery in the vehicle-treated animals, and these are the ones treated with the compound. We take away the compound, wait 1 week, and the effect is still there. So it's a persistent effect, and this is infarct size, and there is no effect on infarct. And we done preliminary resting state connectivity measurements, and we see that the compound restores in part of those networks that the Rich Environment also does. So we have a compound that acts synergistically with the Rich Environment to promote recovery, an inhibitor that removes the effect, which is important if you want to treat and interrupt the treatment. It's effective when treatment starts 10 days. So we start the treatment 10 days after stroke, and it's also effective. So there is a possibility to actually do some kind of pharmacological development based on the enriched environment effect, but we are not finished there at all. There is a long way to go. So here is a general conclusion. I think the enriched environment paradigm is a powerful tool to study mechanisms of recovery after stroke and to identify pharmacological targets that can support stroke recovery. And the next step for us is actually taking the pharmacological treatment into a task-specific trial. So we will have the animal housed in the enriched environment. Then we will take them out for treatment and at the same time train the paretic paw while the other paw is bound to the back. And we'll see if we actually can increase the more skilled functions of the paw. So thank you very much. Enrich your life. I do it like this with my grandchildren. Very individual, because some like Mozart and some like country music. I like Monet, I can't stand anything else. So one has to, that is now an opportunity to do personalized medicine. It may be complicated, but I think a mix of all senses. It cannot be exactly as in the rodent, because as I said, in the rodent it's much stronger impact on their lives. They really are the brains are kind of exploding by stimulation, and I don't know if we can actually attain that in humans, because when it's boring we turn it off. But I think that a positive environment, a motivating environment, is the one. I don't know what you think is a rich environment in your setting.
Yes, please.
Happiness. Now we are talking soft. There are the data on. I love gardening. There are the gardening and music. I think one has to discuss with relatives what the patient liked. I think it's personal. It's highly personal. Otherwise, it becomes. It's like Gav talked about it. If you train something that is not beneficial, you it could get wrong.
This
on the page for no human beings were in such a deteriorating
conditions. Well, have you been in the hospital in Sweden? I mean, it's, I agree. This is actually an impoverished environment. And if we would, that's why I want to have a rich environment combined with skill training, because the rats live down in the ground, running around in holes. So actually, we should have a big pile of earth soil. So I think you're right in the sense that here we have the extremes. And this is on purpose, because I want to siphon out what actually improves function and then test it in a context of skilled water training. We cannot compare this to human beings, and that's why from the beginning stated this is experimental. Please don't put that. But I think in the hospital, people come and visit. If they like visits, that's again a personal. It's a big effort to identify all these factors, but it can make patients motivated for the training to come.
Yes. Anyone else? No. I'm just wondering, as a clinician, because you talked also about SSRI and EndoFA, are you using widely, or your colleagues in Lund, are you using widely in stroke patients when there's no indication like extrapyramidal disorders or depression, but just for the purpose to improve the outcome, to influence the neuroplasticity?
There is a big phase 3 trial here. It's called the EFFECTS trial for fluoxetine in stroke. And it's a multi-center study. Lund is involved in that, so I think there is a lot of enthusiasm. I hope it realizes that there will be an effect. So definitely we will have to wait. I think there are two or three phase 3 trials in the world for fluoxetine. I don't know if this one that was neutral, if anybody takes it up.
I think there are some clinicians who are very enthusiastic and use it already.
Yeah, yeah.
And hope the effect, but it's very different practice
in
the northern land.
It's not detrimental, so I'm not.
No.
I would use it. I would ask for it.
No. I agree. Yes.
Yeah, I just wondered, in which environment there is pharmacological treatment, could it be used in nursing homes as well? Because you have so much inactivity that they need an enriched
environment. Yeah, I think any what has been evident from I take this away. this track. From studies, from Martin Schwab studies using antinovel treatment, it has become evident that you need to combine training, task-specific training, with the pharmacology. Because if you stimulate plasticity and there is no director governing the plasticity, it becomes maladaptive. It could actually worsen. In terms of novel treatment, which is preventing the inhibition of axonal growth, they got a negative effect of novel treatment, long-term novel treatment. But when they put the animals on novel treatment combined with skilled training, there was a dramatic improvement. So you need to have both. I think the pharmacology will not be a standalone treatment. treatment.
That's promising news for physios and occupational
therapists. Yes, you still have work, important work.
Yes, thank you very much.
Thank you.
A little souvenir. I hope you like cheese, you too.
Very much.
Final hour. You have been very patient. I hope you have some sugar in your blood now so you can listen to Louise with refreshing break. Very proud to introduce the last speaker of this small seminar. We will give you the PDFs. No worries. First, let me introduce Professor Louise Ada from the University of Sydney. She's a friend and collaborator, and we're very proud to have you here, Louise. And we know that you will give an excellent speech. Glory to
you. Okay, the sound? Right, so everybody else yesterday started with their visits to Norway. So this is my ninth visit to Norway. And can we have the front lights off the gate? Is that possible? Or not the back one? Anyway, so this, can you see that? I can't see that.
Yes.
So this is a picture of the Bessigan Ridge. And this is a picture of that my husband took after we had walked up the Bessigan Ridge. And I'm not in the picture because I am crying on the ground. I feel like I can be called an honorary Norwegian because I climbed the Bessigan Ridge. But I don't think most Norwegians cry on the way up. They have to be let up blindfold. And the other competition everyone seemed to be having was about grey hair. But I haven't seen my colour hair for about 20 years. So I am hopefully going to give you some good news. And I'm loosely going to talk about what the title was, but I'll talk about some other things as well. And I will also make some comments about what previous speakers have talked about. And they've all gone, so I can stop. In fact, they can't answer that. Okay, so early on in my career, I was reading Randolph Nudo's papers on cortical mapping and learning and very much getting the message that you had to practice specifically and you had to practice a lot if you wanted to learn, both from the rodent models, as we talked about, as well as the human models. Depressingly, about the same time, in the mid-80s, the studies were coming out of America and the UK showing that looking at what people were doing after stroke in rehabilitation units, showing that they were spending about half of their time alone and inactive. And this was going on at the same time, so obviously we were thinking we have to be able to do more. So about 5 to 10 years later, I remember I kept saying, but it won't be like that in Australia. It won't be like that in our rehabilitation units. It's just theirs. They don't know what they're doing. I had a master's student, Fiona Mackey, and we did our study in Australia. I should say that just before this, I did my master's in New York, just to follow up on the previous speaker, and I learnt to do this sort of environmental analysis. And I did an assignment where I sat and watched a stroke patient for about 2 hours. And I literally wrote down everything they did and everything that happened to them. And when I handed my assignment in, we had to analyse it in various ways. When I handed my assignment in, the professor who was involved in education, not involved in health at all, wrote back on my assignment, this cannot be true. This person is in sensory deprivation. This, you know, it's either wrong or it should not be allowed, basically. So I think someone made the comment before that our patients aren't necessarily as badly off as the rats in their cages. I think perhaps they are. And just so I don't forget, I've just written a reference up there. This is a pilot trial of enriched environment that was published in Disability and Rehab, done by Heidi Jansen when she was doing her PhD with me. And she's now, and she describes the enriched environment that she used, translated from the animal model. It's not the only one. Someone was saying there's one by White, I think, which is also Australian. But Heidi is now doing the bigger trial. She has funding to, and that's going on at the moment. But if you're interested, there's quite a detailed, reasonably detailed description of the enriched environment. I just said that so I wouldn't forget. Okay, so back to this. So, of course, we had a look at our units, and what did we find? Exactly the same. And then, at much a year later, this was in Sydney, this was in Melbourne. They did the same thing and found a little bit different, but they counted things a little bit differently. I think it was really exactly the same. And what I remember getting out of that is that I remember when we sent our paper to be published, the editors said, you can't, in the discussion, you can't, you're making the therapist look like they're lazy. That was the interpretation of it, that the therapists weren't doing their job because the patients were alone and inactive so much of the time. But in fact, the therapists, we weren't measuring what they were doing, but what I remember from watching them was the therapists were running around like blue-ass flies. You know, they were busy, busy, busy. It wasn't the therapists that were the problem. It was the patients that weren't doing much. So it's not that the therapists weren't working hard. It was obviously something to do with the way we organise our systems, especially back then. So this is then another Australian study. These aren't all the studies that have been done, but this is Julie Bernhardt looking at it in the acute unit, in the first week after stroke. So all the others were in the subacute inpatient rehabilitation units, and she came along and found, as you might expect, given that they're not always allowed to get up, an even worse situation of patients being inactive. And that was really looking at that and doing more studies like that that sent her down the track of doing the AVERT trial, of looking to see what would happen and trying to get people up earlier. So at around this time as well, people were starting to do trials of extra practice. So obviously the message was getting out that we should be doing more practice. And Gert did the first systematic review of physical outcomes back in the 90s, 97 I think, if I recall. And I think it had about 5 or so trials in it. And then he came along and updated that in 2004, and you can see there were 24 trials, and looking at the outcome of ADLs, activities of daily living. And in those 24 trials, he got the effect at the end, the standardised mean difference was 0.13. Now, when you look at a standardised mean difference, you're looking, the units are a standard deviation. So it's not clinically meaningful. So there have been definitions. The one that's mostly used is by Cohen. 0.2 is a small effect. 0.5 is a moderate effect. And 0.8 is considered to be a large effect. Once you get up to 1, it's a very large effect. So you can see then Verbeek looked at walking in 2011, looked at extra practice of walking, and he's got still a small effect though, 0.32, standardised mean difference. And then the most recent one, Lotzi, came along in 2014 with very similar to Gert's trials, looking at all recovery with 34 trials. But again, much the same size, a small effect. But again, in a lot of these trials, there wasn't a lot of extra practice. So a small amount of extra practice, small effect. Okay, so a PhD student and her other supervisor and myself wanted to do our own meta-analysis, our own systematic review of this, and which has just been published, I think literally just been published, which I'm going to show you. But first of all, I want to tell you what we were trying to do and why we did another one. Every one of these, I think every one of them, in the discussion part of their papers suggested that there was a dose response. So that is, the more extra practice, the bigger the effect. But no one actually looked at it. But we have ways of looking at that. So that was one of the things we wanted to do, to see whether there was a dose response and whether there, and if we could work out what the threshold for that was. The second thing was that in a lot of these trials, they're not truly dose trials. So a true dose trial is when one group gets a certain amount of practice and another group gets extra practice that's exactly the same content. Whereas a lot of the trials in these meta-analyses are a mixture of type and amount. So yes, they get extra practice, but the practice is different. So you're not sure whether they're doing better because there's a better type of practice, or whether they're doing better because of the different amount of practice. So we wanted to restrict ours just to dose trials. Those trials that the control group got something usual and the experimental group got more, but of the same content as usual. So we were not mixing up type of practice. Does that make sense? Okay, so this is... So this is some of the inclusion criteria for our review. They had to be with stroke, and again, a lot of studies don't have 100% of the participants are stroke. So we usually have a cutoff that says as long as 80% of them are stroke, and that the others are stroke-like. Maybe they've had an aneurysm. Not something completely different, like multiple sclerosis, but something fairly similar to stroke. And what we ended up with is the interventions from 2 weeks to after 6 months, so quite a variety. We didn't put any limit on time. But most of them, about nearly 90% of the trials were done within that subacute period, less than 6 months, most of these studies. And we were looking at extra rehabilitation of the same content as usual. The trials that we came up with, 9 were done in the upper limb, 4 in the lower limb, and 2 were a combination. They got both upper and lower limb extra training. And the measurement we were looking at was some form of direct observation, not a self-report, but direct observation of the performance of upper or lower limb activity, depending on what the intervention was. That were our criteria. Okay, so here's the overall forest plot. Now, I hate presenting graphs to people very quickly, as people have been doing for the last 2 days, and assuming that you all know what they mean. So I thought I'd just take 30 seconds to describe how you should look at a forest plot. If you already know that, just go to sleep for 30 seconds. But for those of you who don't, this is each individual study. Or maybe I should use this. These are the individual studies. And what you have here in the square is the mean difference between the two groups, between the experimental and the control group. And the line either side is the 95% confidence interval. Where's the mouse gone? So for that, that's the 95% confidence interval. In other words, it's the variability of the result. If this line up the middle, in most cases, it's at 0, but the line up the middle is telling you where there's no effect of the intervention. So if both the mean and the the line, the 95% confidence intervals are right of the line, that means it's statistically significant. If it's like, let's say, this one where the mean is to the right of the line but the confidence intervals cross the line, it means it's not statistically significant. All right, you haven't got that p-value. And then, of course, you've got the same, if it's to the left of the line, it's suggesting that the control group's doing better than the experimental group. So then, statistics are applied and these estimates, as Alex said this morning, these estimates are pulled into a summary. And in the middle of the diamond is the mean effect. And again, the spread of the diamond is the 95% confidence intervals. So the narrower the diamond, the better. It means the more believable, the stronger the result. Okay? Everyone who knew all that can wake up now. Alright, so what we've got here is, if we put all these trials all together into a meta-analysis, we get a standard mean difference much the same as previously, 0.39. So the previous two were about 0.35. Again, a small, getting towards moderate effect. The confidence intervals don't cross zero, so we're fairly sure we can say there's a beneficial effect to the extra practice. But it's not a huge effect. However, one of the things the statistical analysis also told us was that there was heterogeneity. And what that means is that what it's saying is the studies look like they're fairly different. And therefore, you should have a look at why they're different and whether there's something you should do to rectify that. And so what you do is what's called a sensitivity analysis. You look for the differences. So the idea is you say, well, what could be causing it? What if we take all the low quality, it could be quality, what if we take all the low quality trials out? Does that make it better? What if we look at sample size? Again, as Alex was saying, we know that small trials tend to overestimate things. What if we take all the small samples out? Does that make it better? So we went through this process and none of these things made any difference to the heterogeneity. They were still all over the place. The only thing that explained it was the amount of extra practice. So what we did is to say, why don't we divide the trials into those who have a little bit of extra practice and those trials that have lots of extra practice. So we decided to, you've got to do this before you do the analysis, we decided, of course, it's not necessarily all that easy to do that because the trials are all different and they've got different base amounts and different amounts of extra. And so what we did was we had to turn into a percentage. How much more practice percentage-wise were they getting? So we said, let's have our cut-off at 100%. That is, the small amount of extra practice is actually doubling the practice and the large amount is everything more than that. So, at the top few trials are the trials that were doubling the amount of practice, that is a small amount of extra practice, and the trials below, and you can see that for those trials, interestingly, the diamond is sitting right on naught. Doesn't make any difference. Once you then get rid of them and look at the large amount of practice trials, that is more than 100% increase in practice, you've got a bigger standard difference. It's up to about 0.6, which is a moderate effect. So that was quite encouraging. That's really suggesting a dose response. That is, the more practice people get, the better the response you'll get. So then what we went on to do, we did a correlation, which again suggested that there was a dose response. But then we did an analysis of using an ROC curve analysis. And I don't particularly want to explain it too much because it's not my favourite thing. But what happens is that you plot, you you plot the false positives against the true positive rate, and you get a curve, and the RSC curve is particularly useful for giving you a threshold. So where the curve turns the corner is suggesting that's the point, that's the threshold at which you need to do enough, so much extra practice in order to be guaranteed of a good outcome. So we had to work out how much extra practice they all did, and I should say the other thing that we did was we were very careful about how we worked out the extra practice. So, for instance, if we looked at Gert's 1999 trial that he talked about this morning, the control group got about 50 minutes, got about an hour, and the extra practice was about an extra half an hour, was it? That's what he said, something like that. I can't remember exactly. But the point is, the people that got extra lower limb practice, they didn't do an extra 30 minutes on top of an hour of lower limb. Only that usual practice, only some of that was lower limb. And in fact, I think it turns out to be about 15 minutes of it was lower limb practice. So in actual fact, they got an extra 30 minutes on top of 15 minutes of lower limb. And that's a much more accurate representation of what's really going on. And we were as careful as we could be about doing that. So in fact, those people in the extra lower limb group were getting 200% more practice than the control group. And so what you're looking for, and there's a formula to do this, is the change in this curve as it goes around, and it tells you the threshold at which you can be sure of a good outcome. And that turns out to be, in this case, about 250%. In other words, to be sure of making a change for the better, a change in the outcome, if we're going to give people extra practice, we have to increase it not by a little bit, but by a large amount, which may well also explain some of the graphs this morning that were shown and said, you know, extra practice doesn't always do anything. It wasn't enough. I was sitting there tearing my hair out. It's not enough. You didn't do it enough. We know now that you didn't do it. It's got to be lost. And so really what we need from now on, if you're ever thinking of doing an extra practice trial, lots of extra practice, not a little bit. So I hear you ask, what? It's all very well to say it in percentage, but what does that really mean? Well, these studies, the base, if we average what they were getting, the control groups, for the activity, they were getting 25 minutes. So in order to get a good outcome, on average, the practice they were doing for that activity, if it was upper limb or lower limb, was about 1.5 hours. Instead of just under half an hour.
1.5 hours a day.
Yes. But again, yes, per day. Per whenever it was being done. Which is a bit daunting, don't you think? I mean, it's good news in some ways. I think it's really nice to actually have a guideline, if you like, something that's a bit more than just do more practice. But on the other hand, it's a bit daunting because it's a lot. I don't know. I think maybe that's the point where I can say I think that the duration of studies actually shouldn't inform our clinical practice that much. The frequency and the amount per week or per day perhaps should. But you know what? I've run an awful lot of clinical trials, and I can assure you, I don't choose to do the intervention for 4 weeks because I think that's the perfect amount of intervention. I do it for 4 weeks because I know if I do it for any more, I'll lose half my participants. They'll move back to the centre of Australia, and I'll never see them again. And therefore, I won't have a result, basically. The duration of which we test things isn't the duration we should be doing them clinically. Perhaps the intensity and the frequency is, but not the duration, because they're not chosen they're chosen for practical reasons, not for clinical reasons, if you like.
Do you think there's a rule of how much practice you should
probably
have done?
Yes.
Do you know anything about this?
No. What you can see from the previous slide is I have less trials in there, isn't it, than the 34 that Lopes you had. But that's because we chose them very specifically that they were dose trials and not type trials. But we need more dose trials to put in to answer that question. I feel pretty happy that we answered, you know, the threshold question. But no, I don't think we can answer
how much, practice the
top one? 500%.
Of what?
25 minutes. 500%. And they still got better, by the way. They didn't get worse. So on the whole, except for that little dip in the curve, on the whole, that curve is behaving almost perfectly, except for that little gap of the blue part of it. That is, at one end, it's if you do a small amount of practice, you don't get a benefit. Large amounts of practice, you definitely get a benefit. In the middle, round about 200%, much more unclear. That's why it's 250 to be sure that you'll get an increase. So look, the message is I'm not really wanting you to work out every tiny 250% to the minute. The message really is, I think, is that if we're going to increase practice, we have to do it properly, and we have to, and it's lots. It's not a small amount. That's the message. So I've been obsessed for most of my career with amount of practice and how much patients do and pushing them and bullying them. And I'm going to talk a little bit about some of the studies and trials and mostly the reviews that I've done looking at that. But I'd like to start by saying I'm not in favour of any particular intervention. I look at interventions in terms of how much practice they can afford. Not anything to do specifically with the intervention. I'm not in love with treadmills. I think, though, that they often afford more practice, and therefore they're a good thing. Anything that affords more practice is a good thing. So I first became interested and thought about holding people up in some sort of harness when I was a clinical educator. And being a clinical educator, you can stand back a bit, you can watch your students, and you see how stupid some things are. And what's stupid is having three people with a stroke patient who can't walk themselves stagger with this stroke patient across a room after about 10 metres for the student to turn to the patient and say, "Are you tired yet? Do you need a rest?" The patient doesn't usually need a rest. It's the students that need a rest. And I'm usually going to go, "No, they don't need a rest." Keep going. But, of course, left to their own devices, that's exactly what happens. Everyone sits down for a rest. So at the same time as people were actually developing some of these machines and harnesses to hold people up, we were thinking, I'm sure a lot of people in the world were thinking about the idea, wouldn't it be easier if I didn't have to hold them up, if something else held the patient up, and then they could practice walking. And then you've got the problem is, if you hold them up, they're stationary. So the only reason you need to put a treadmill under them is because you're holding them stationary, and it's a way of making the floor move. So I just wanted to have a look at... Oh, that's the summary of that. So I just want to have a look. This is a systematic review that I'm going to come back to of mechanically assisted walking with body weight support for non-ambulatory stroke. And later I'll come back and we'll actually have a look at the results. But really, what I want to point out, all of these studies were versus them, done very acutely. They were... In the actual review, there were six studies, They were all prepared with overground walking, that is, therapist-assisted overground walking. But the interesting thing is, three of the six studies actually reported how much practice was done. And I think it's very interesting. That's, in fact, the most interesting bit of the whole thing. Because if you look at the TOM experiment and look at the, how much the control to the experimental body in terms of steps taken, the control group, that is the therapist-assisted overground group, got 10% of the amount, took 10% of the number of steps that the experimental group did. The whole study, they took 20% of the steps, the number of steps that the experimental group did. And in our study, they took, we measured distance, not steps, they took 20%, or they walked 20% of the distance. That's not a lot. And yet, both groups were given the same amount of time to do their practice. They both had, usually it was 20 minutes, sometimes it was half an hour. It was always between 20 minutes and half an hour. So the time was the same, but the experimental group was doing up to 10 times, at least 5 times as much actual practice in that time, purely because the machinery afforded it. Not because there's anything magic about it, it just affords doing more practice. Someone else is holding it up. You can stop for a rest, sit them down in the chair. You don't, after you've gone through all the effort of getting them on it, you're not going to let them off. You know, yes, you can have a rest and then you'll do some more. You know, there's something just about human nature that means that having got into this position, you're going to use every bit of it that you can. Whereas 10 metres is often enough before people are saying, I think that'll do. And we did some observation, which we haven't published, which we should get back to, which actually suggested that a lot of the time people who are not ambulatory don't get walked at all. So the therapists always tell me that they, oh yes, we walk them and we get 2 or 3 people, yes we do, but actually often something happens and it slips off the end. And it's quite common for them, not every day, but often not to get any practice walking at all. It's just too hard. Okay. Okay, so the next problem was that, of course, there was the world was divided. I'm not sure it was divided evenly, but certainly back in the early 2000s, the world was divided into those who thought it was perfectly fine to put stroke patients on treadmills and those who thought it was the most terrible, evil thing you could do because you were going to ruin their walking. And so this is some data from Suzanne Coase, who, and this was part of her PhD back 10 years ago, and she was particularly interested in people who could already walk. She was interested in cardiorespiratory fitness, and she wanted to train people's cardiorespiratory fitness using the ACSM guidelines. That is, getting people to walk at 60% heart rate reserve, and for about 20 minutes in order that she could, as soon as they could walk, in order that she could send them home being fitter than we know we usually send them home. And all her colleagues wouldn't let her do it. That was horrific. She was going to ruin their walking. It was all going to be horrific. So her PhD got completely sidetracked by having to prove to her colleagues that she wasn't going to ruin their walking. So she did a number of studies. But this was the final one, which is a pilot randomised controlled trial of high-intensity treadmill walking. So this is people who are still inpatients. They have just started walking. So our definition of that was that they were greater than or equal to number 2 on the walking item of the motor assessment scale. And they had reasonable cognition. Not wonderful, but that had to be more than 24. So what we ended up with in the trial was, on average, they were about 7 weeks after their stroke. They were walking at 0.4 on average, 0.4 metres per second overground, and their mini mental was 28, so they were okay. The intervention, as I said, was to try and get them up between 40 to 60% heart rate reserves and to lengthen the duration up to 20 minutes. And we measured the feasibility of it, but we also measured, was it detrimental, as well as did it have a benefit. So the way we measured feasibility was the usual thing that people measure. We measured how many sessions were completed, that is the compliance, the withdrawals, the adverse events, and it was all reasonably okay considering how hard we were pushing, and 89% compliance is pretty good. Okay, so this is what happened over the 6 weeks of the intervention. So this is the percent heart rate reserve, and you can see that it took quite a while to get there. It's really up to about 4 to 5 weeks before most of the population are actually inside the bandwidth of 40 to 60%. And so it's not that that was a shock to us, but it did suggest to us that we needed to have a longer period than 6 weeks intervention, because you spend the first 2 to 3 weeks getting them there in the first place. We just can't, they're just not good enough at walking to be able to push them up there. This is the duration of the session. Again, we're looking for at least 20 minutes, and you can see that again it's up to nearly 5 weeks before we've actually got most of the participants into that bandwidth. So we measured detriment. We did, again, what Bert was talking about this morning, we did quite a lot of kinematic analysis. And we measured, I think, either 10 or 13, sorry, I can't remember, but let's be conservative. We measured at least 10 kinematic variables. So we measured linear ones, the ordinary step length, walking speed, the timing, those sort of things. But we also measured some angular ones. So we measured angles at various points. And what we found was that in the experimental group, they had 6 degrees more hip extension at the end of stance phase. That's a good thing. How often do we struggle to get people to extend their hip more? And they had 9 centimetres more step length on their non-credit side, which is the side you want. That is, they're standing on their credit leg and they're taking a 9-centimetre longer step with their other leg. Again, probably because they've got more hip extension. We also, just to be sure, we also made videos of the patients walking. We randomised the videos in order, mixed all the patients up and gave them to some therapists who had to rate their quality of walking out of. They didn't know what group they were in, but we also mixed up the order of pre and post. So they just looked at them one after the other and rated them out of 10. And there was no difference between. They couldn't tell who was who. So even running people high to intensity before they can walk very well, 60% heart rate reserve for 6 weeks, or getting up there for 6 weeks, there's not been done anything detrimental to people's overground walking. Has it made a benefit in terms of what they actually do? 8.18 metres per second more walking speed at 6 weeks, which increased beyond the intervention at 3 months. 62 metres more walking distance on the 6-minute walk test at 3 months. Right, sorry, at 6 weeks, and then it dropped a little bit, which often happens with, because I think there's a bit of a fitness component. They went backwards a little bit. So I don't think we should still be talking about not putting people on treadmills because we're scared that it'll be bad for them. Maybe for other reasons, maybe it's too expensive or anything else, but not because we're going to ruin their walking. Okay, just to show you I'm not addicted to treadmills, I also wanted to tell you a little bit about this review that we did recently. And this is a review of the trials looking at you queuing cadence. And mostly they were using metronomes, but they didn't always. Some of the trials used music to provide a beat, either music or a metronome. So in this systematic review, we included people as long as they could walk. and our definition of being able to walk was without help, but didn't matter whether they used aids, and at least at 0.2 metres per second at baseline. In other words, they really could actually walk. That's not very fast, as you know, but some of the studies do try and do it when people can't really walk, which I don't think is quite fair. And we weren't particularly concerned for this review about whether it was subacute or chronically after stroke, because we're looking for the effect, and there's no reason why we perhaps, with people who are already walking, why they may not benefit from this further down the track. So what we ended up with, were trials where people were taken into them very early, at 2 weeks after stroke, up to 15 months, so a bit over a year. But 60% of the trials were within a month. So most of the trials are early on. It's only a few that are the later ones. And the walking speeds, the average walking speeds of the participants varied from 0.23 was the lowest, so that's pretty slow, to 0.63, which is about half of normal elderly speed. So they're moderately to reasonably disabled. The intervention we were interested in was cueing their cadence using beats and versus walking training alone without the cueing. And it didn't matter, as I said, whether the beats were delivered via metronome or whether they were delivered by music. But we didn't include the studies that use music as feedback. So there are some studies that use music and it's more as a feedback, not as a cue that they have to match their steps to. We measured walking and we measured as many different aspects of walking as possible. And we're particularly interested in symmetry because, of course, that's one of the things you would particularly expect to be affected by using a metronome, that people would become more symmetrical. Most of the asymmetry in walking after stroke, by the way, is to do with the timing of it, not to do with the spatial aspects of it. Do you know that? Do you? So you when you see someone walk and it goes kalunk, kalunk, and it seems very asymmetrical, if you measure their step length, they're often very similar. It's not that asymmetrical, step length. But if you measure the timing of their steps, it's very asymmetrical. And so you can imagine in that case that metronome should be a sensible intervention. This is the easiest, almost the easiest systematic review I've ever done. Every trial had the same design. They all were walking training alone versus walking with metronomes or beats. And they all measured speed and stride length, and most of them measured cadence and symmetry. And you don't often get that me tell you. So what that means is I can present the forest plots to you in real units, not in standardised units. So here, this is walking speed, and it's in metres per second. So the overall effect is about, if I recall, about 0.23 metres per second. That is, the experimental group that got the metronomes while they were walking walked on average 0.23 metres per second faster than the control group. That's huge. That's the biggest effect I've ever found on any review that I've ever seen or done myself. And it's just $20, 100 odd pounds for a metronome. So in some ways I agree with what Gert said. You don't need to have fancy equipment. It doesn't mean that some of it isn't useful or it may not work, but you don't need to. This is one of the reasons I wanted to show you this. This is one of the biggest effects that I've ever seen in walking intervention for stroke. And it's one of the cheapest interventions. And it's the same for the others. This is stride length, and it's about 21, I think, maybe even more, 22 or 3 centimetres more in the experimental group. Now, that's stride. Remember, that's 2 steps. But still, that's a lot, isn't it? You would see that with the naked eye. It's not just a number on here. You would actually see it. Okay, so steps per minute, not, we're not so interested in a small increase, that's fine. And not only some of them measured symmetry and a little bit all over the place, but on the whole there's about 15% more symmetrical. Doesn't mean they became absolutely symmetrical, but their experimental group's heading in the right direction. So a very simple, very cheap intervention has a really rather a large effect, which is very encouraging. Okay, so then that's my attempt to summarise this. The findings from the meta-analysis suggest that on average it was 30 minutes with queuing of cadence. On average it was 4 times a week. In moderately disabled ambulatory individuals after stroke, is superior to walking training alone in terms of walking speed and stride length in the short term. This was immediately after the intervention. Very few, if any, of these studies did a longer term follow up to see whether that was maintained. But certainly the immediate result of the intervention were that. Okay, now I want to do something really just to be cheeky, which was to go to the other end of the scale and tell you about a case study. Although, you know, Gert seemed to think it was a good idea. But I just wanted to tell you about this intervention, which I also think has the potential to be very powerful. It's called covert monitoring. It sounds like a military operation, and it is a little bit. So the idea is that it's a way of counteracting the deterioration outside the therapy area or outside what the therapist's controlling. So part of it is the patient must be able to perform the task to criterion. So if you want someone, in this case it was a woman, to be able to walk with long steps and a narrow base of support, then the patient must be able to actually do it. The problem is that they don't do it when they're not being nagged by us as therapists. So then the patient knows that they're going to be monitored out in the real world, as in out of the therapy area, but they don't know who the monitors are. That's why it's covert. So this case study was of a woman, and they were the two things she had to do. She was going to be monitored 5 times a week for 2 weeks. Her walking was reasonable, but the minute she walked out the door, it deteriorated. And we employed 7 monitors once a day, and the monitoring was spread across the day. And what they had to monitor was that she had a reasonable length, step length, and a narrow width. And the results were collected and graphed every day and fed back to her every day. That's the important part. Okay, so here's what happened. So the maximum she can score is 14. She gets yes on 2 things each day. 14. 7 monitors. Yes? Okay. Do you see what's happening? So first of all, the first day you tell her that she only gets 2. This is the beginning of the trial. It's on the end of her bed. You put the thing on and it's 2. And this woman, she was furious. That can't be right. That can't be right. I did better than that. No, you didn't. So the next day, she gets 3. Right, that can't be right. And so the more incensed she gets, the better, because the more it makes her engage, as people were saying yesterday, become motivated, engage in the process. So instead of the therapist being like us, like this nagging person, you're not walking with long enough steps, get your feet together and whatever, she starts to take responsibility for monitoring that. So every time she walks down the corridor, every person she sees is a potential monitor. So after a while, she's walking really badly. She sees someone, she goes, oh my God, I know. So the thing is, the more she does that, the more she, oh my goodness, think about walking and thinks about, the more automatic it becomes that she just starts doing it all the time. And so what's happened is, by not very far, but by the time now. By the time she's up here, it's really, she's just doing it. She's doing it all the time. Because every time she's watched, no matter how much you try and catch her out, she scores nearly the full score. So, do you see how powerful that can be? And we've even done it with people with cognitive problems. You have to do it a bit differently. We've done it with someone with TBI. We needed to add rewards in, actual, not just the reward of seeing the graph, but an actual reward, a physical reward. But it has the potential, I think, to be a very powerful, again, not very expensive, not very difficult intervention. I've never had a PhD student who wants to do a trial on it, which is why I can't report a trial to you, but I would love to someday. I think it's got a massive amount of potential through the mechanism of engaging and motivating what people do. Okay, now, I did want to talk a little bit about the fact that though not all practice makes us perfect or makes our patients perfect. And one of the things that we're battling against is, as people have been talking about for once we get to the human model, is the heterogeneity, particularly of stroke. And they're heterogeneous from our point of view, from their physical point of view, not only because they have lots of impairments, they don't just have pain, they have spasticity and weakness and loss of coordination and contracture and, you know, on and on and on. They've got lots of impairments. But also, the variance in the impairments that they have is huge. And I actually thought, I wonder if I can prove this. So I looked up, and this ACL injury was from a systematic review of a lot of participants. And if we look at their knee quadriceps strength, then they have a 31% deficit. I had to put it in terms that I could compare. So compared to normal, their deficit after ACL injury, this is with hundreds of patients, is 31%. Now, that's not that different to after stroke. This is from Simone Dorsch's PhD, of about 60 ambulatory people. So people who could walk had a 41% deficit. Not that different if you look at the mean. But look at the confidence intervals. The ACL, there's two either side of the 31. They're so narrow. They're all the same. All those patients are the same. But if you look at after the stroke, it's much wider. There's much more variability that we have to cope with. And so I think what we need to do is think about the different, how can we subgroup patients. Now, there's already been a lot talked about this in the 2 days, and I'm looking forward to being able to subgroup them on the terms of whether they've got a particular genotype or whether they're non-responders or responders, but we can't do that yet. But we can do it in ways that we can measure. And one of the ones that because I'm interested in walking, I've been using, is this idea of Jacqueline Perry's years ago when she did a very famous, now famous study, which has stood the test of time, that basically took people's walking speed after stroke when they returned to the community and basically said, but what can they really do? And came up with these categories, which I'll simplify for you because that's a pretty messy slide, that basically says if people can only walk less than 0.4 metres a second, they're likely to be a household walker. That is, they're going to be confined to the house. If they can walk between 0.4 and 0.8, they'll be a limited community walker. That is, they can get out in the community, but they probably need a bit of help. Whereas if they can walk faster than 0.8 metres per second, they can get out into the community, they can go shopping, they can do cross the road without being run over, they can walk fast enough to do those things. And I think these, as I said, we've used these, I think they stand the test of time actually, they're quite useful as you'll see. So, this is a study that my Brazilian PhD student did, Lucas, and he took people who were living in the community, chronic stroke, that is greater than 6 months, who were not habitual users of walking sticks. In Brazil, they think walking sticks are just as evil as everywhere else. And we gave them a walking stick, and this is immediately measured with and without, it was randomised, but with and without the walking stick. And if you look at the whole group, they didn't really change very much. Their walking speed got a tiny bit better, their step length got a tiny bit better, and their cadence changed a little bit. Really, on the whole, you'd say no real change, giving them a walking stick. Then we subgrouped them using the categories of 0.4 and 0.8 cutoffs that I just talked about. So the slow walkers, if we look at just their walking speed, if you want to read the paper, there's other things in there as well, but if you look at their walking speed, the slow walkers got a little bit better. 0.06, they walked a bit faster. Not only just significant and not probably clinically significant, you probably wouldn't be able to pick that up with the naked eye. You wouldn't notice any difference. Look at the intermediate walkers, though. The intermediate walkers, they increased their speed by 0.18 metres per second. That's huge. You would definitely notice that, and they definitely noticed it. But interestingly, what happens to the fast walkers? It got worse. In summary, without all those figures, the slow walkers were much the same, maybe a little bit faster. The intermediate walkers were much better, much faster. But the fast walkers actually got worse. In a way, the fast walkers didn't need the stick. And what you were doing was giving them a dual task. And it's like, have you ever tried to walk with a stick? It's like, where do I put this? When will I put it down? Because they don't actually need it. So it actually becomes quite a difficult cognitive task. Whereas if you want one and it'll do you some good, you almost automatically use it. You don't really almost need to be taught to use it. So the point of this, though, is that they didn't, if you looked at the group as a whole, you got nothing. But in fact, there were quite different responses, which makes sense when you think about it, if you look at them as subgroups, and the fact that we can make people worse. So this is, I just wanted to share very quickly, of the subgroup analysis that we did of the ambulatory trial. So this is a trial where we had three arms and we got people who were living in the community with their stroke, who could walk in, and we were trying to run them fairly fast on treadmills to try and get them better at walking. And so this is the trial, this is the details of it. So what happened is when we looked at the whole group, as we reported in the main results, there was a small effect of intervention, not a large effect. But when we looked at them in the subgroup, and what we did was we separated them at 0.4 metres per second, when we looked at the disabled, the very severely disabled people versus the less severe ones, there was a differential effect. So what happened is the severe people didn't change, they didn't respond at all, they didn't get better. But what that meant, once they were, if you like, out of the picture, the group that was less disabled got much better. It was a big effect. Okay, same thing with Kathleen's study, the stroke clubs trial. People living in the community with stroke, going along to stroke clubs, offered some extra exercise, extra therapy, extra program, an exercise program, and they were interested not only in making their walking better, but falls, whether they could prevent falls. Again, if we look at the walking aspects, being distance, small effect of the intervention. But again, if we subgroup them, there's a differential effect according to walking speed, the same as ambulate. The severe people did not respond. The better walkers, the faster walkers, responded quite a lot. Falls, overall, no effect of the intervention on falls. It's hard to get an effect for falls. A hard thing to do. However, again, if we subgroup them according to walking speed, there was an effect. But guess what? We made the severe, the slow walkers, we made them fall over more. So they fell more than the control group. It was like we pushed them too hard, almost, as it were. So the message out of this was really to say not everyone will respond the same, which of course you know, but in terms of where they are, in terms of how disabled they are, but also that we can make people worse. Just as we can make people better, we can make them worse, and we therefore need to think about who, be specific about who our intervention is for. And look, trying to make a list of what the implications of this are, we need to think about, there's a lot of discussion going on about subgroup analysis now, and one point of view is that we shouldn't necessarily go searching for subgroups after we've done the trials. Those subgroup analyses were exploratory. We didn't have the power and we didn't say we're going to do it a priori. We did it post hoc. We were exploring to raise questions. To power a trial for subgroup analysis, you often need four times as many participants as with the original trial. So it makes it even harder to do. So the thing is, a lot of people are arguing that we're better off being sensible in the first place. Rather than just taking everyone into the trials, is we take people in who we think, using our clinical judgment, will most benefit from that intervention. And what that means is we, as authors, have to make sure that we report both the inclusion criteria and the actual characteristics of the sample we ended up with, so that you, reading them, can know who the people were, what their characteristics actually were. But also, what we should do as authors, but we don't very often, is we should report not just a few things about the intervention, we should report about the participants, the intervention, the centres, the outcomes, what the comparison was, what the setting was. You need all that information to know whether it's applicable to your clinical situation. And this was written up in an editorial by a Norwegian, two Norwegians, I think, and a Dutch person, back in our Journal of Physiotherapy back in 2008. Okay, so just to come back to this systematic review of mechanically assisted walking and body weight support, this review is out of date. It's 2010. Reviews get out of date as soon as you've done them, so now it's really out of date. But I promise you, I'm in the process of updating it. And in fact, one of the trials that will be going into it, as it was done at Stillness Hospital. But I want to make a point about it, all right? A lot of people have said, and anyone who was at London for the conference last year will remember, it wasn't exactly a Barney, but they were saying, you said it works and you said it didn't work, sort of thing. And really, it's about how you ask the questions and set the parameters of the review. So I just wanted to point out what they were. So our criteria for this were that people had to be non-ambulatory. It's beyond me why you want to put people who can already walk into body weight support. So we only took trials that were non-ambulatory participants, and we defined that. We also thought, you know, if you can't walk by a year down the track, you're probably not going to walk no matter what happens. So we wanted just to look at that early subacute phase. So we said we're only taking in trials that are before 3 months, and the characteristics we ended up was fairly early. Okay, I didn't really care what sort it was. It didn't just have to be treadmills or whatever, it could be gait trainers. As far as I was concerned, you might disagree, but the idea was if they were going to be mechanically assisted, they would do more practice. Didn't matter what sort of mechanical assistance it was, they would do more practice. So we ended up with 6 trials, 2 on a treadmill, 3 on a gait trainer, and 1 other on a treadmill. Five of them had a harness to provide the body weight support, and one of them was a robotic, I presume it was a locomotive. So we looked at the amount of independent walking that was established, and back then these were the trials that went into it, and nearly 25% of more of the experimental participants that got the assisted walking walked independently, both at 4 weeks and at 6 months, than in the control group, which again is quite a lot. Again, the reason that I think this has a bigger outcome and result is because there are different inclusion criteria for the studies and the participants than other people have used. It's not full of trials in the chronic phase when people aren't going to get better, for example. So, because I've run out of time, again, the idea is that the summary for this isn't it works. If someone says something works or it doesn't work, don't believe them. It's not don't believe them, but it's not enough information. The information is that mechanically assisted walking with body weight support is superior to overground walking, because that's what the comparator was in every trial. For non-ambulatory stroke patients, not for everyone, but for non-ambulatory, undergoing rehabilitation in the subacute phase, not down the track, in terms of establishing walking, that's what the forest plot I showed you was, and does not appear to be detrimental, I skipped over those forest plots, but it's true, to walking safer distance in the long term, that is 6 months down the track. So can you see that's not saying it works or it doesn't work, it's saying under these conditions it works. And so you, as the consumer, need to decide whether those conditions are the same are the same as yours. Okay, so I'm out of time, aren't I? So can I tell, which is sort of not half the talk, but anyway, there's another one showing the same thing. So just to finish off, I think that we need to think, for example, here we are in subacute walking rehabilitation, I think the first thing you need to say to yourself is my patient ambulatory or not, in terms of what you do? If they're not ambulatory, in practicing walking, you have to support them. I don't care how you support them, as long as you do the same amount of practice that gets the best result. You don't have to put them on a treadmill or on anything else, but you have to do that amount of walking. And that was at least five times the amount of normal overground walking was done. Afterwards, you can do high intensity. The same thing here for chronic walking. Use walking speed to differentiate what you do. If they're at 0.8 metres per second, probably they're walking okay around the community, and we should concentrate on cardiorespiratory fitness. If they're in the middle, these moderately slow walkers, we can do high amount of intensity of walking training. You can give them a stick when they're out and about. It can't do them any harm, and they'll walk faster if anything. The other thing, the 0.4 metres and less, on the whole, we know they're housebound, they're isolated, we actually also know they're depressed. We need to provide them with strategies. We haven't finished our job. Yes, they can walk to the toilet, but that doesn't mean they'll have a good quality of life. We need to provide strategies for them to get out in the community. And the next few slides were, if you look at this in the PDF, were some of the data that we've collected that shows that people who are very slow walkers are isolated and depressed at home. And I just leave you with skip over all of those and I'll just leave you with my last writing. This is my mother-in-law on the right, who had a stroke. She died last year, but before that she had a stroke, very, very bad motor stroke. I learned an awful lot from her. And she went home, she very cognitively on the ball, like Gert was describing this morning, people who are very motor disabled but cognitively okay. She went home, having had a lot of therapy, and I continued to bully her, and she walked, only just really. She walked to the toilet, she walked around the house. She was a classic household ambulator. No one, to my high embarrassment, no one or myself ever did anything about making sure she could get out of the house. I mean, she had a husband who could put a wheelchair in the car, but she felt guilty every time he did because she thought he was going to hurt his back getting the wheelchair in and out of the room. And it was 3 years after her stroke that one day I looked at her and said, oh my God, she needs a scooter. And she lived in Canberra where they have lots of cycle tracks, as you can see here, and this scooter transformed her life. She had 3 scooters in the end, one in the car and one in another house. But I just give you that message. We may have got people walking, we know they can't get much better, but that doesn't mean you can't improve their quality of life by looking at how they can get out.
Thank you very much. So otherwise you can take it afterwards with stay on. But because you're such a colourful person, you get an orange package. So I know you have an orange package. Thank you very much.
I hope this is brown cheese. I like
it. And that is Victoria. As I said, I would like Marianne, Aina, Angelique, Lina, Suzanne and Ronga. They are my helpers, and you always have to be take good care of your helpers, so please come forward. I've forgotten Ume and Anne. I had too many roses. Where are the other roses? So please, thank you, my dear collaborators, who have made this very helpful. Seminar. I'm grateful that you came. I'm sorry that we couldn't have a bigger audience. It was worth it. We will send you the PDF. We will send you the participants. Somebody wanted that as well. Somebody wanted a note verifying that you have been here 2 days. We will give you that as well. And we will also have a film in the end. So, well, we say thank you and go home safely.